This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You open the auditory door, you come in, and you find out what's going on in the world. Do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to anyone you can think of, really. And a thanks to those of you who've recently reviewed us, including Joanna, Veet Vujagig, Vince B, IC Mac, Adam Zaks, Claude Verdi, Dr. Stardust, Bear Gwills, look, I didn't write this, and Owen R. Keep them coming. And if you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, particularly given the news, our podcast from last year about NHS funding. In this edition, I'm getting briefed on Iran. Why are the latest protests happening? Who are the protesters? And how will the authorities respond? That was Ardabil in northeast Iran earlier this week, but it could have been any one of a large number of towns and cities. So far, 21 people have been killed, perhaps over 1,000 have been arrested. Iran is a strategically important country with a violent recent history, so when big protests happen there, the world takes notice. There were last large numbers of people on the streets in 2009, mostly in the capital Tehran. So what's going on this time? Who are the protesters and what do they want? And how will the Iranian government react? And how might the outside world respond? Step into the briefing room to find out. Hadis from Tehran told us what happened at a recent demonstration.
This time there were as many security guards, if not more, than in the 2009 protests. Many of them were surrounding the city theatre building. There was more of them than actual protesters. I mean, maybe for each protester on the street, you'd see 5 special guard officers and 10 plainclothes agents. There were so many of the plainclothes agents that it was hard to tell who was there to protest and who was there to stop them. I mean, you can't tell if the person standing next to you, who looks exactly the same as you, is one of them or one of us. So you can't trust anyone. I saw them shoot rounds at the people. They ran into people on the pavement with motorcycles and hit them. They were beating people very harshly. They were especially brutal towards women. They beat me too, very badly. Several of them jumped on me and beat me up together, maybe 4 or 5 of them at once. A really important thing that happened was that when the protests got heated, suddenly 400 or 500 men, who were unusually large, stormed towards the crowd and shocked people with tasers. They were shouting religious slogans like Hail Imam Ali and his unforgiving sword.
One voice only among many, but useful to hear. Iran is in some ways still a mysterious country to many of us. So for some context, Dr. Roham Alvandi, an Iranian Associate Professor of International History at the London School of Economics and Political Science, came into the briefing room to help me out.
Iran's a hugely significant country. It's one of the largest countries in the region, about 80 million people. And geographically, it's very large. It's about three times the size of France, and it stretches all the way from the Caspian Sea in the north to the Persian Gulf in the south, from Afghanistan to Turkey and Iraq in the west. It's a massive oil-producing country. It's a rather unusual country in the region, in that it's a majority Persian-speaking country, unlike most of its neighbours, which are Arabic-speaking. And it is a Shia Muslim majority country, which again makes it somewhat unusual in a region made up mostly of Sunni Muslim states. Iranians have always called Iran, Iran. But the rest of the world called Iran, Persia, until the 1930s. And that has to do with the fact that the Greeks referred to Iran as Persia, and so that tradition carried on in Europe. But the Iranian government insisted that in the 1930s that the rest of the world should refer to Iran as Iran. Its power and influence really has to do with its culture and with the ideas that have emanated from Iran. It's a country that has been an incubator of many of the modern political ideas that have shaped the Middle East, from nationalism to political Islam, to debates about modernity and secularism, to debates about the relationship between religion and politics, and really what it means to be a modern-day Muslim nationalist in the Middle East. In 1979, a popular mass social revolution overthrew the Shah of Iran. What united them was a sense of anti-imperialism and a sense of Iranian nationalism. They accepted the leadership of an exiled Iranian cleric, Ayatollah Khomeini, who'd been exiled to Paris, and from there led the revolutionary movement against the Shah. A whole variety of political movements, of groups, Marxists, Maoists, nationalists, liberals and Islamists, all came together under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini. And we have to be careful not to label this revolution as necessarily or inherently an Islamic revolution, because all these different people who opposed the Shah saw in Khomeini what they wanted to see. And Khomeini was deliberately vague in exile about what exactly he would do once he returned to Iran. But what they were all clear on was that they opposed the Shah and that they opposed American imperialism and they wanted a return to some kind of authentic Iranian nationalism, which increasingly took on an Islamic tone. What we've seen over the last 40 years is a changing of the guard in Iran. The generation of the revolution, the generation who toppled the Shah, are really reaching the end of their political careers. And what we're seeing now is the emergence of a generation for whom the most formative political period was the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. These people essentially have gone through a sort of intensive university of statecraft. You have to imagine Iran in the 1980s was isolated internationally because of the Iran-Iraq War, because of the Tehran hostage crisis. And so they had to learn how to survive and how to maneuver in very dangerous political waters. And they did that quite successfully. They managed to maintain Iran's independence throughout the Iran-Iraq War at a time when basically the entire world had lined up on the side of Iraq. They survived the death of Ayatollah Khomeini. The final frontier was political liberalization and cultural liberalization, which is what happened with the election of Mohammad Khatami to the presidency in 1997. Those early years of Khatami's presidency were an incredibly exciting time in Iranian politics. I mean, it really felt as if anything was possible and that the Iranian revolution had finally reached maturity. But of course, that was not to be. There was a tremendous backlash by conservatives in Iran. And also, unfortunately, it also coincided with the atrocities of September 11 and the war on terror. And so we saw the emergence of what some would call the Iranian neoconservatives under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and a resurgence of the more radical revolutionary ideas of what the Islamic Republic should be. And that struggle, that battle, is still playing itself out. The 2009 elections were a moment when Iranians were confronted with a really substantial choice between re-electing Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, a neoconservative who had isolated Iran internationally, and potentially another reformist president, someone in the political tradition of Khatami. So they participated in the presidential election of 2009 in huge numbers. The candidates who are allowed to run for president are tightly controlled, yet there was a sense that it was important to vote. It was important to participate in the elections because the outcome would matter. And so when people perceived that there had been some kind of intervention in the election, they were angry. And so they came out into the streets in huge numbers. There was a sense of a betrayal, of a breach of the contract between the Islamic Republic and the urban, educated, largely secular Iranian middle class. The reaction of the state to those protests, the transformation of Iran into what some have called a security state since then, has been a very traumatic experience and has created divisions in Iran, has created political fissures in Iran that are still unresolved.
Dr. Roham Alvandi. Recordings of the demonstrators suggest that economic discontent is a critical factor in bringing them out onto the streets. Behram Tajdin is Iranian and is a reporter for the BBC Persian service. He's been looking into standards of living by analysing official figures from the Iranian Central Bank. I asked him into the briefing room to tell us what he'd found.
We have been looking through figures for the past 20 years, so from 1997 until 2017, which was the latest year that the data was available for. And we have been looking at a measure called the household budget, which reflects both your income and your assets. And what we have found is that from 1997 to 2007, which is the second year of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's presidency, the standards of living, this household budget measure, has been going up almost year on year, and it has grown by something like 40%. So people are getting better off and better off year by year. But since then, since 2007, the living standards have dropped by 15%. So in other words, Iranians today are on average 15% poorer than 10 years ago, which means they have to cut on some of their expenditure. For example, they have to buy less expensive food, go on fewer holidays, and that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's talk a bit more about what they have to cut, what the impact of taking a 15% hit in your household budget means.
I think one of the best examples of that is food. Iranians were drinking twice as much milk just 7 years ago than they are doing today. They were eating 50% more red meat 10 years ago than they are doing today. And that is a very important symbol for Iranians. So eating meat, eating red meat, shows your wealth. If you have to eat less meat and eat more chicken, then you're poor.
What's behind this drop in living standards?
Probably the most important reason is the high rate of inflation, which some economists say that it is due to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's economic policy. On top of that, since 2007, Iran has had international sanctions imposed on it, which cut its access to many international financial markets, and more importantly, cut Iran's income from exporting crude oil. On top of that, this is the time that people like me, people who are Iranian baby boomers born in 70s and 80s, are now coming into the labor market. You see many of these people leaving universities, but this is happening at the time that there aren't many job opportunities out there available. And on top of all of this, what we have seen is over the past 20 years, the cost of housing in Iran has grown faster than the rate of inflation, 2.5 times faster. These days, you can see that the average rents are 55 times more than what they were 20 years ago.
Behrang Tajin, that's the economic background. But who is actually out there protesting? Has the nature of the protest changed over the week? Xiaogol is also a reporter from BBC Persian and has been looking at just this.
We looked at 55 cities and towns. We have witnessed in the past few days the unrest, and in some of those cities, very violent. In almost 90% of them in the past 2 years, there have been the history of peaceful demonstrations. So it wasn't something out of the blue. Say, oh, of course, many, many journalists, many people caught off guard. But in one hand, in Iran, it goes unnoticed. And when it's not that big, and normally we don't see it abroad as well.
So just to be absolutely clear, unnoticed by most of us, but probably noticed by you, in those places where there have been violent demonstrations this time, there has actually been a history of peaceful demonstrations before now, over the last 2 years.
Yes, there have been hundreds of people in many different cities. As I said, in 90% of those 55 cities which witnessed unrest in the past few days, there have been actually peaceful demonstration. Most of those people were pensioners, workers, teachers, fishermen. The workers and factories weren't able to pay their salaries, or teacher, they couldn't get their benefits, or pensioner, they couldn't get their salary on time, or hundreds of people, they invested their money and their saving in financial institutions, and those institutions collapsed and bankrupt. No one were there to pay them back.
So they've been demonstrating about loss of income, they've been demonstrating about loss of savings, they've been demonstrating about the lack of value in pensions. This is all over the course of the last 2 years. These have been basically economic demonstrations.
Also unemployment, inflation, and environment, you name it.
Now, when we look at past demonstrations in Iran, they've been typified by the children of the middle classes coming out to protest against illiberalism or something like that. What you're suggesting in this instance is a kind of rather different kind of protester.
This time around, the protesters were unorganized. They weren't from educated and elite class or middle class.
Who do they blame?
What I'm reading from the slogan, what I'm reading what people on social media are saying, those people who are protesting, entire establishment of Islamic Republic of Iran. We were hearing death to President Rouhani. They tearing down also his picture. They attacked his representative offices. There is a two institutions. One is a supreme leader and another actually is a revolutionary guard, which are the symbol of Islamic Republic of Iran. Those two institutions were attacked. This time around, it wasn't the demonstration like 2009. The elite, those people weren't happy, or reformists weren't happy with the result of the election. This time around are the people, the poor, who the government almost 40 years ago came to power to serve them.
That's the who, where and why of the Iranian protests. But where's it all leading? To discuss the events of the past few days, I'm joined by Hassan Hakimian. He's Iranian and director of the London Middle East Institute. And Azadeh Mouavani, Iranian writer and journalist who's been covering the region for nearly 2 decades. She's in Cambridge. Azadeh Mouavani, if I can start with you, do you also perceive these demonstrations as being very different from those of 2009?
Absolutely. I've covered protests in Iran since 1999. Of course, the student riots of that year were the decade before the 2009 protests, and it seems to me different than both instances. These are very young, primarily male. There's been a big debate, actually, about whether are they hardcore working class or are they provincial lower middle class. But clearly, these are young people who feel like they have no stake in the system whatsoever, who are so aggrieved that they just want to burn the whole thing down.
And is there a degree of spontaneity here, Hassan Hakimian, that you see in these demonstrations?
What has happened in terms of the speed, the contagion, the ferocity and the militancy with which the riots have built up has surprised a lot of people, and this is not something that was foreseen. Although if you talk to a lot of Iranians, they seem less surprised than either the government or outside observers like ourselves.
Azadeh Mahavani, in 2009 we talked about the kind of the social media organisation of it. The idea was that there were distinct organisers and then the thing kind of took off. And there's no talk of that here.
That's absolutely right. I think partly it's because the genesis of it was very different. In 2009 you had a very specific movement that came out of an election that many felt was tampered. And so there were specific grievances. They wanted an election recount. There were leaders, people who participated in that election. So that was about, where is my vote? We want more accountable democracy. And there was leaders and there was a vision. This time around, there is no leadership. There has not been any kind of driving theme. And so it's been very fragmented.
So let's now talk about the reaction of the Iranian government. And here we face a problem, a kind of almost definitional problem, don't we? One of the things that confuses me is just who exactly is in charge in Iran on a day-to-day basis, first of all, and then second, when demonstrations like this happen, you have to make a decision about what to do. Who makes that decision? Hassan?
Well, officially, of course, Iran has a government, one that was voted into office through a landslide election 6 months ago. But Iran's constitution also limits the extent of the president's powers. There is a labyrinth of decision-making which has evolved in the last almost 40 years after the revolution, which interferes with decision-making almost on a daily basis. For instance, the Guardian Council, which vets the candidates for elections and also has the job of ensuring enactment by the parliament are in accordance with Islamic principles. And this affects daily life in Iran as well.
Does President Rouhani tell the Supreme Leader what to do, or does the Supreme Leader tell President Rouhani what to do? And if not, who decides when they have a disagreement?
Well, ultimately, the Supreme Leader tells everyone what to do. That's how the structure of the Islamic Republic works, and that's why it's such a convoluted structure. It is a theocracy with rule sanctioned by God in the hands of the Supreme Leader, and then you have this elected government that is meant to be a republic. And the reason why it's convoluted is because anyone can imagine that that's basically unworkable and has proven itself to be so. It is more complex than that, though, in that the Supreme Leader is confronted with reality and an 80 million population, the realities of the world, the region, the world economy. So President Rouhani has leverage, and his elections and the elections that are built into the system give him leverage. That is an enormous and powerful stamp of legitimacy. So if you can imagine, it is very contested. But ultimately, we've sort of seen in the last 4 years especially that reality is powerful leverage, even when the constitution enshrines ultimate decision in the hands of an ayatollah.
OK, so when you get a crisis like this, though, and you have to decide you're going to go one way or the other with the protests, which of them decides?
I don't think that they have wildly diverging positions right now. I think that clearly everyone across the establishment wants to slow it down, recognizes that the whole system has been refuted by it and has a stake in acknowledging the legitimacy of the grievances and the demands. It is to everyone's benefit that this be tidied up in a civilized way and that it not become a taint on the system as a whole.
Let's look at President Rouhani, because he is the person who actually we in the West tend to deal with most. Hassan Hakimian, what do you think his response is and what will he be trying to achieve?
Well, I think the recent disturbances have no doubt put Mr. Rouhani and his administration in a delicate position. They come to him as a big surprise. The reformers are not used to being in the dock and target for widespread and popular anger. They are more accustomed to offering an alternative, a more hopeful Iran, which is how they have capitalized on popular dissatisfaction over the last 2 decades, at least, winning major elections. So there's a big surprise factor. And precisely because coming only 6 months after a second landslide victory, that in itself would have given Mr. Rouhani justification to believe that a large section of the Iranian population has given him the mandate to carry on with his policies, both politically and economically.
What do you think he wants to do now in the light of the demonstration? What do you think his strategy will be?
Well, there are two things. One is short term, how to be seen to restore peace and tranquility without resorting to the sort of securitized measures which are the monopoly of his foes. I think that's a delicate balance. And beyond that, he will have to ensure that his vision of a more prosperous Iran in which the youth
do not lose hope, the middle classes do not choose to leave the country in droves, is acquiring credibility. And that is a tall order.
Atsede Moaveni, that's not the kind of language we've heard coming out either from the Revolutionary Guard or from the Supreme Leader, is it? Ali Khamenei has blamed foreign intervention. There's this talk about seditionists. What do you think their strategy is?
I think the talk of seditionists and foreign agents is just the inherited language of a revolutionary regime that at moments of crisis says those things, just like Iranians have been conditioned to say death to this, death to that. I mean, there's a language that both sides use. So I would pull back a little bit. There is a fracture within the regime. There is a strong hardline element that is seeing Rouhani's vulnerability vis-a-vis the Trump administration wanting to torpedo the nuclear deal. I think that the international economic backdrop to this cannot be overstated. I mean, Rouhani promised big. He promised 1 million new jobs a year. He promised that if we sign this nuclear accord with the West, that everyone's lives would be transformed. And that required a set of measures, sanctions relief, reintegrating Iran into the international banking system, an environment in which foreign investment would come to the country. None of that has happened. So this is a populist regime. Its legitimacy rests on being able to deliver some of these things. If you can imagine Corbyn getting elected and everyone's living standards dropping, to understand the extent of kind of political crisis it is that none of what's been promised by the West alongside the nuclear deal has been delivered. So I think the divide within the regime itself, where you have a security establishment, a clerical establishment that ultimately wasn't really on board with that, that was very happy to keep Iran isolated, fragmented, continue to sort of exert its influence through proxies in the region, that divide stands, and the hardline element that never wanted any of this to come about in the first place is seeing an opportunity to come out and undermine Rouhani.
Hassan Hakimian, put like that, this doesn't look like an opportunity for the West to support reform. It looks like a dangerous moment for Western policy.
Well, the West has to be very careful in the manner in which it does or it does not interfere. Judging by what the White House has been tweeting in the last week or so, one fears that this will play directly into the hands of the hardliners, in fact. And this will strengthen the hardliners' accusations, which were leveled against Mr. Rouhani at the time when he was negotiating the nuclear deal, that you just simply cannot trust them. But of course, we have to differentiate between how different Western countries have reacted to the situation in Iran. Most countries have acknowledged the recent protest, have supported the peaceful right to protest, and have asked the government to respect those rather than to clamp down protesters.
I think either way, whether there's a sort of fulsome response or a tepid one, I don't think that it makes a huge difference on the ground. No hand of aid is going to be extended to them. I think in terms of what the factions in the regime or in the government that will exploit whatever Trump says, you know, would be inclined to do that anyway, I don't think it makes a huge difference. I think what does make a difference is being even-handed, recognizing, as I think the Europeans have, that Iranian public opinion is actually very divided on these things.
Now, if you had to express very quickly for a British listener why what happens in Iran matters for the rest of the world, how would you put it, Azadeh Moaveni?
I would say that in a region today that is inflamed by collapsed states, you know, increasing dictatorships in places like Egypt, open civil wars, you know, Yemen collapsing with famine, Iran is a populous country that has been relatively stable, that's assisted in the bringing down of ISIS. It is a traditionally westward-looking, fairly moderate population. It's had its big Islamist experience. It's kind of looking beyond it. I think this is a country that can be a bedrock for stability if its leanings outwards into the world through this nuclear deal are maintained, and the government is given more incentive to pull back in the region rather than to be more aggressive.
Hassan Hakimian, one of our contributors earlier talked about how the current Iranian leadership, the generation, has been through the most intensive university of statecraft since 1979. What do you think will happen with them next?
With every crisis comes an opportunity for some faction of the government to assert itself and turn a problem into an opportunity. In fact, this was the language that Mr. Rouhani used himself. But I think the situation is far more serious, and this is a wake-up call, if not for the entire regime, certainly for the reformists, because their options, as I said earlier, both in the short term and long term, to offer an alternative, a more peaceful, tranquil alternative to the large swathe of the population now seem more limited. And this is a defining moment for Iran's reformers.
Well, that's it. My thanks to my guests, Dr. Roham Alvandi, Behrang Tajdin, Jia Gol, Hassan Hakimian and Azadeh Moavani. Until next Thursday, good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Jim Frank. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.